Oh, you are recording.
Yes.
Next message. We are recording.
Okay. You sure not?
So give us the big smile, please.
Just in case, I've got my video camera on record here as well. So welcome to everybody there. It'll, my video camera will only record my side of the presentation here. So you may find me repeating questions, etc. That's just for the benefit of people who are listening. So take it away.
Okay, thank you very much for the backup. And perhaps the first and most important thing, Stephen, we are not alone. Yeah. Perhaps you can see some people around me. There's a small crowd of around 50 people.
Yeah, I see them.
Standing, sitting there. The camera's just moving. And as we agreed on a few days ago, you would like to start a very short, Q&A session, if that's fine for you. This morning we started already discussing some topics covering knowledge management and enterprise 2.0 and collaboration and such things, and trying to collect some questions for you. So if that's fine for you, I would start with the first question. And
Sounds fine to me.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much. People are very curious to know about what's your favorite learning theory?
My favorite learning
Surprisingly.
Theory. Gee, do I get to say connectivism?
That's a short answer.
Let's start with the short one.
I mean, my theory is that learning is the formation of connections in the mind. And that activities that lead to learning are activities that lead to the formation of connections in the mind. And that the engagement in communities of practice and networks of learning in society, are those activities most likely to foster the forming of connections in the mind. That's a very short version of it. And you can find similarities between that theory and a number of other theories. You know, there are constructivist elements in it, although I would describe formation of knowledge differently. There are connectionist elements in it, which is a theory of mind, philosophy of mind, computer science. There are activity theory and activity network theory elements in it. So, you know, and I'm not even going to claim that my theory is unique to me, because it's not relevant that it is. That's basically the theory that I hold.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm just looking around if that's okay for you or something to add on.
No.
Okay. Sorry, but the questions come very unsystematically.
No problem.
The next one is, and perhaps with regard to connectivism and the current online course, a very interesting one. Regarding collaboration and networking, are there intercultural differences you're aware of?
I'm sorry, could you say that once again, please?
Regarding collaboration and networking and community building, are there intercultural differences you're aware of?
Intercultural differences?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, there have to be. But what would they be? That's a good question. I mean, there have to be intercultural differences simply because different cultures constitute society differently, different cultures constitute community differently. I'd be hard-pressed to state exactly what those cultural differences are without an in-depth study of some other culture. I mean, the only other cultures I really know in any depth at all are Canadian First Nations cultures and Canadian Francophone cultures. You know, I can talk about the difference between Canadian Anglophone and Canadian Francophone cultures somewhat just in the different nature of the perception of self in the two cultures. And this is borne out if you study the language that is used in English and the language that is used in French. And in English, your pronoun construction is a very simple mind, you know, self-world kind of thing. Your comments either pertain to the self, the person, or to the world at large. Whereas in French, we see construction which would distinguish between the self, the body, and the world. So in English, I would say, I am sick. But in French, you would say, I have a sickness. You see the distinction. So there's going to be a consequence to how people in Anglophone cultures perceive self and how people in Francophone cultures perceive self, and how that's going to cash out. Now it's going to be a matter of examining the literature, examining the culture, examining the society. So that's a quick take at it.
Okay. For example, with regard to the different tools you use during the connectivism course, for example, the wiki, the local groups, are there differences?
Well, it's interesting. The connectivism course, our Spanish language participation is almost entirely through the communities of practice that they've set up, the Connectivitas. And that is partially, as I recall, a Google group, and partially, as I recall, a Second Life effort. Although I can't say I haven't been into the Second Life component of that. From what I can see, the Americans seem to be participating mostly through the discussion list.
Okay.
What else? I can't really characterize the bloggers as having a nationality. They're coming from everywhere. There's about 140 blogs now in the course, and they come from everywhere. Although I find it rarer to find, say, a European in the discussion list. There are some, but there's not a lot. The discussion list is kind of a rough and tumble area where people aren't always cautious with the words that they use. And so, and I think we're seeing elements of that, but not necessarily cultural demographics, but I think we're seeing fewer women in the discussion area than we might otherwise. That's a bit of speculation on my part, but there does seem to be a majority of men in the discussion area, and I am seeing a fair number of women participating through the blogs. Online, Illuminate participation, and again, this is without hard numbers, seems to be pretty much across the board and international. I'm not seeing any particular cultural flavor to that. So those are just off the top of my head observations. I haven't really been looking closely at that thus far, although yeah, we have data, so we will be able to figure that out after the fact. We're going to have so much stuff to figure out after the fact. If you guys have a team of like 40 researchers that would like to help us examine the data, that would be real nice.
Okay. Perhaps I would like to move on. That's one question from one of our digital natives. What do you think are the core competencies for the 21st century? The core competencies.
Yeah, I did write a paper once called Things You Really Need to Learn. Yeah. And I would say that the core competencies I think are needed are probably outlined in that paper. And they begin with fairly basic aspects of critical reasoning, how to predict the future, how to communicate, how to understand what other people are saying, I mean, and understand in a deep way. Some of them are practical skills, even things like how to be healthy, which doesn't seem to be a practical skill applied by many at the moment, including myself, I won't deny that. Finally, to skills related to finding your place in the world and defining your own identity. So things like how to value yourself, which is not a skill that's taught in school, so far as I can tell, and how to live a meaningful life. And this is a way of finding your own place in the world, in society. And again, this doesn't seem to be taught in schools, except perhaps in a specifically religious context, but I would want to see this taught in a broader context. I think a lot of the skills involved in functioning in the 21st century world have to do with personal empowerment have to do with, you know, the standard phrase is taking responsibility. I really don't like that phrase because it's empty, but it has to do with making choices, accepting to a certain degree that where you are is a result of those choices, and then as a consequence, learning how to make good choices, learning how to respond appropriately to your own condition and the condition of the environment around you. So it's more of a, if I had to characterize it, I would say it's much less subject-focused, it's much less topic-focused than a curriculum of the 20th century would be, and much more process-oriented, much more, you know, how to deal with information as it comes in, how to deal with a rapidly changing world. I mean, even if all technology were to stop, we're already committed to a rapidly changing world. I mean, that's going to happen no matter what. So that's the sort of skill that we're going to need in the 21st century.
Okay. What's the role of communities and networks with regard to these competencies? Something especially to mention, or?
Well, communities or networks is kind of a hard question. We have to redefine our role in community. I've characterized this in some cases by the distinction between groups and networks. And I could characterize community in the 20th century as a group phenomenon, a mass phenomenon, a phenomenon based on the characteristics or the properties of the members, a phenomenon that places great value in conformity, in being the same, in sharing a vision, in having a common voice. In the 21st century, we're looking more at a network phenomenon where communities are not characterized by identity or sameness, but rather through the way we interact with each other, the way we connect with each other. So 21st century community will be a community that values diversity, a community that values autonomy, a community that's open and sharing, a community that embraces change, embraces the dynamic nature of the world, embraces creativity. So, you know, it's a different role that we're playing in community now. Being a part of community isn't being the same as other people. It isn't just following along with the crowd and agreeing with what your neighbors agree with, voting the way your father did. It might not even be voting. Community now is first and foremost defining what your own place in that community is, who you are, how you are going to participate, how you are going to interact, what are the conditions under which that interaction will take place, how you will provide value to the community, how the community will be able to provide value to you. That sort of network type of behavior where you understand that every single individual, and not just those who lead, have a particular role in shaping what could be considered the knowledge and the value and the strength of the community as a whole.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I will start. Just have a look around. Just find the guy who provided this question, but I can't figure out. Ah, something to add on, or? Okay, he's completely satisfied. So. another question, what about the role of emotions in learning, especially with regard to e-learning?
Well, emotions are important. One of the great fallacies of economics is that people are rational decision makers. And it's just astonishing that any science would view people in that way, whether it's economics or psychology or education. Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting diagram.
People are trying to confuse us, yeah.
Yeah, hang on just a second here. I want to capture this from my video.
Would you please tell somebody draw it?
That's very interesting. Was that created just now?
Yes.
Must admit, eh?
The artist is in the background. I can't.
Where's Marcel? Please, Marcel.
Marcel.
Yeah. So it's almost a little frightening.
That's the artist.
I'm just Marcel, well, cool, thanks.
Dave Kendrick.
I hope it was a good subject. I certainly stood still.
Okay, sorry for this.
Emotion.
Coming back to emotions.
I mean, emotion is a sensation. Emotion is a way of your body and your brain telling you how things are going. It's a sensation like the senses, like what you see, what you smell, what you taste. It's how you feel. Emotion is the result of various chemical, physical properties taking place in the brain. Emotion plays a role. Emotion is a reflection of how your mind is reacting to the world and to circumstances. It very often guides people. It probably guides people more than it should. Just simply acting blindly on emotion is akin to acting blindly based on what you see at first glance. Emotion is a source of information. It should be valued. It should be embraced. It should be felt. There's beauty in emotion just as there is beauty in sight or beauty in song. So I think emotion plays an important role in learning. I think people who are aware of their emotions can use this awareness to provide feedback responses to others in the environment. It's one of these principles of communication, right? Tell other people how you feel. If you tell somebody, I feel threatened by what you just said, what you are doing to them is describing a perception that you are having, but you're giving them information that is useful for them to focus or reconstitute their own activities. So, I think I would never think that emotion is not a part of learning. Mm-hmm. I think probably the standard answer to that question would be just talk about motivation or something like that. But in my mind, questions of motivation are addressed by approaches that have to do with choice rather than attempting to work with or manipulate a person's emotions. The result, the motivation, which is a type of emotion, comes as a result of and can be a part of reporting on the amount of self-control, the amount of, I don't want to say control them again, but the amount of control over their own environment, the amount of security that a person feels in the environment. And that can be relayed back to the people who are having an influence on that environment.
Okay, thanks. Just a look around. Okay. Another question, another big one. Mm-hmm. How can we ensure orientation and quality in times of information overload and unlimited access to resources?
Orientation and quality?
Yeah.
Two separate questions.
Okay.
the short answer is through networks. Okay, you probably saw that coming. We can take quality as our starter case, and in the field of computer science, internet science, there is a subfield known as recommender systems. Now, it's still not the most mature field in the world. Nonetheless, there are well-known mechanisms and algorithms that can be employed to allow a large number of people working autonomously but interacting as in a network to collectively filter a body of information such that what that network perceives to be quality, if you will, rises to the surface. And the most accurate way of saying it is it would be passed through the network and, as they say, recommended by the network to others. The idea here is, I mean, there's a few things going on, right? Because a question like how do you ensure quality at first blush seems to assume that there is some objective standard called quality. that materials can adhere to, and if we just matched it against some sort of standard, that would do the job. But the problem is there is no such thing as an objective standard of quality. Different things have different value to different people at different times. And in the internet world, the closest we can come to quality, quote unquote, is people like you tended to rank favorably under such and such dimensions, things like this under circumstances like that. So the evaluation of quality becomes very much a pattern matching kind of exercise, where you're matching people with other people, or you're matching circumstances with other circumstances, where you're matching resources with other resources. And then this, in turn, becomes a question of identifying properties. Which properties of a resource are salient to quality? Which properties of a resource are irrelevant? Similarly with people, with context, etc. This is a matter of empirical determination, right? We need to set up our network in such a way that we can measure this, that, or the other of these properties and identify similarities and employ an algorithm in order to produce recommendations. But then we have to look at the recommendations and say, was that really the thing that I thought was good? Because, you know, in the end, we have to look at the results of these systems and feed back information to correct them. And you know, there's this sort of system isn't set up as though, you know, it's a turnkey kind of operation. This sort of system is the sort of thing that we as a society as a whole are going to build over time and going to tweak over time, because it's the result of, you know, not 1,000 lines or 10,000 lines of code, but, you know, 100,000, a million separate connections between resources and between people across various dimensions. And the tweaking of these connections is going to take a certain amount of time. So that's how quality is addressed. Topic is addressed in a similar way, except the filtering mechanism is filtering for topics rather than quality. And topic, you know, the focusing on whatever the topic is again simply a matter of, does a resource have such and such a property with respect to the point of view of such and such a person? What sort of property, you might ask? Well, one way I organize topics on my own website is I use regular expressions, and I define a topic, quote unquote, as a predefined regular expression. I apply the regular expression to the text and the resource. If there's a match, I say, okay, that resource belongs to that topic, and that's how I organize topics. And the way I tweak my definition of topics is by tweaking my definition of the regular expression. But I don't just work with the regular expression theoretically. That would be silly. I tweak my regular expression, then I look at the output list of resources and say, well, is that output list what I had in mind when I created the regular expression? And that becomes an iterative process back and forth. That's just for me. And now you take that work in my context and you multiply that across the society and you get a large set of regular expressions and some way of expressing that possibly as a single expression or possibly as multiple iterations of the expressions on the same resource, and that gives you a more collective way of identifying what the quote-unquote topic is of a resource.
Stephen, as far as I can remember, the quality issue came up during our Enterprise 2.0 discussion. Is Enterprise 2.0 for your topic?
Enterprise 2.0?
Yeah.
Do I have such a topic? Is that what you're asking?
Is this a topic for you, or is it something you just have a look at from a distance, or is it shaping your thoughts in a way?
Enterprise per se, when I think about governance quite a bit, and I think about society and culture some, I think about learning some, but not enterprise, not so much the organization of companies, the organization of industry. I mean, right now, the way we organize industries, we have predefined organizations. You either belong to them or you don't, and somebody sits at the top and they tell you what to do. And I just don't see anything remotely resembling that as the way of organizing production going forward. I just don't see it. I don't see how you could have an empowered population working in that kind of environment. So, you know, I don't even know where to begin with EnterBev, because nobody who studies business, to my perspective or from what I can see, is even interested in the concept where the basic premises of business are undermined, where the basic premise of the purpose of an organization is to make money is overturned, where the precepts of growth and marketing are actually harmful to the enterprise. But I think all of that would be the case in a network model of an enterprise. So I haven't really had a whole lot of incentive to go into that field. I think that alternative enterprise will develop of its own accord, just like alternative learning will develop of its own accord, and outside the existing and the traditional system, and over time, over 100 years maybe, as a replacement to the existing system.
Okay. Just have a look around. There is something, because we had a very exciting discussion on Enterprise 2.0, there's something you would like to add, or? Well, people are very quiet at the moment.
Yeah, either I'm answering the questions very well or very poorly.
but in general, what's your relation to corporate learning? You just visited Brandon Hall.
I was just at Brandon Hall, and my relation to corporate learning is distant and cordial. I'm just kidding. I mean, from the perspective of corporate learning, I'm a bit of a gadfly and was introduced as such at Brandon Hall. I see a real contradiction in corporate learning that doesn't go away, and no matter how we approach it, it doesn't go away. And the contradiction is that while learning is intended for the benefit of the individual, corporate learning is intended for the benefit of the corporation, which is fine if those two things align, but increasingly they don't align. Particularly when the corporation has no loyalty to the individual and therefore no intrinsic motivation to actually increase the skills or capacities of the individual, but simply to create behavioral competencies which increase its return on investment. You know, there's a fundamental disconnect there. You know, how the whole idea of learner-centered learning, or even learner-empowered or learner-controlled learning, is antithetical to the corporate structure, which suggests that it's the needs and the interests of the corporation that will determine what the learning is and how it will take place. There's been discussion by people like Jay Cross and others about informal learning, and a lot of what I say resonates with that discussion, because we talk about a lot of the technologies in common, a lot of the processes in common, and informal learning, even in a corporate domain, involves a lot of personal control and personal choice. But anything the corporation does with respect to informal learning also places an element of control on informal learning. And as soon as that element of control is placed on it, again, you're moving away from the needs or the interests of the individual. So my role in corporate learning is to tell corporations that really their best approach to learning is to allow learners to increase their own skills and capacities to the greatest extent possible, in whatever direction those individuals should choose, and then to adjust the corporate mission and profile to match the skills of its newly empowered employees. But people don't seem to buy that.
Thank you very much. I still have two or three questions, so mm-hmm. I'd like to move on. Will work and learning change when the digital natives arrive at the workplace?
Will work and learning change when digital natives arrive in the workplace? I would have to say it will. There are the standard sort of characterizations of the digital native, that they're more connected, that they're more independent, that they approach learning and software differently. And then there are the negative characterizations that they're not as smart, they don't read as well. All of these characterizations are, of course, overgeneralizations, but all of these characterizations, of course, contain an element of truth to them. I think that people who are entering the workplace will communicate in different ways, will more likely form networks outside the immediate corporation. Now, the corporate wall is traditionally very large, and there isn't a lot of interaction between people who work in different companies traditionally. But as people enter corporations with, 300 Facebook friends from wherever, they're not going to suddenly cut off these connections. That just doesn't seem plausible. So although their personal networks may shift over time to reflect, the fact that they meet new people, have new interests, and are doing new things, nonetheless, many of the connections that they've established in previous lives or in previous employment will continue. So I think people will work in a much more densely connected network of interactions. And I think that will shape their communications, both inside the corporation and outside the corporation. It will limit the extent to which information can be managed with respect to these individuals, because now they have multiple sources of information and not simply their own employers or their own co-workers. And so consequently, it will be harder to create, if you will, and foster a particular or idiosyncratic corporate culture. So there will be less element of control. Okay. And that seems to be characteristic of what they're calling the millennial generation anyways. There's very much a hands-on element of this generation, very much I can decide how this works for myself elements. And I think we see that. That's not to say they're good at it. It's simply to say that that's how they do it. And they do it that way because that's how the tools that they use are constructed. And so they will probably take that with them as they enter the corporate world and the world of learning. More of a discovery, more of a hands-on, more of a don't show me the manual, just tell me how it works kind of attitude.
Okay. That sounds a little bit more optimistic than your statement on corporate learning for me. So there's still hope.
Yeah, well, I mean, when that generation collides with that tradition, there's going to be sparks, there's already sparks. So, I think it's optimistic. It's optimistic for the people who are working, who are coming into these environments. It's not optimistic for those who want these environments to stay the way they are now.
Thank you for this clarification. Another question. Do you see an alteration of our cultural concept of personality driven by new media and communication?
Cultural concept of personality?
Yeah. Will it change in a way?
That question has multiple meanings. The personality might refer to an individual's character, or it might refer to celebrity and celebrity culture.
Which first way would you like to move on?
It moves on the stage of celebrity culture.
Would you like to come over? Just a second. It will.
Yep.
A little change.
No problem.
So it's up to you.
Is this the camera?
Okay.
Oh, hi, Stephen.
Hi.
My name is Andreas, and the question stems from the discussion in our work group this morning in Heidelberg. May I give two examples of what we have been discussing? One, the speed of new media allows, for example, in a situation of conflict resolution, integrating lots of people in the into the conflict. On the other hand, we observe that the tendency, especially of young people and digital natives, to deal with the conflict in person and backing the consequences of the conflict behavior is not what we can observe. So on one hand, we have a more integrative and a faster conflict resolution pattern, and on the other hand, we have a pattern in which the person itself is less visible. And we observe also that the need for observing a person who takes over responsibility seems to be stronger every day. I can also give easily other examples, but maybe this shows where the question goes to. Is there a cultural change, how we think, or how personality is structured in our societies, driven by new media?
Okay, so the sort of phenomenon you're attaching your thinking to is a phenomenon where when a person is, if not anonymous, at least not a concrete presence in some social situation, where they tend to act in a more, I'm looking for the term here, abrasive fashion, less congenial fashion. Is that the sort of thing okay. And because it's certainly something that's observed, right? If a person can post in a forum anonymously, they feel like they can post anything, that the rules don't apply. Even if a person has an identity, if they're posting in a forum to people they never see again, they feel like the rules don't seem to apply to them. So it's funny the other side where you said that conflicts tend to be or can be resolved more quickly, because my observation is with new media, conflicts escalate rapidly. They go from 0 to 60 in like seconds, and you know, your best buddies and somebody drops a remark and away you go. But yeah, I can see how you can bring more people into conflict resolution, but bringing more people in helps only if those people don't get swept up in the conflict. And it seems to me they do sometimes. I think in general, we are going to have to learn to be more, shall we say, accepting. That's a bad way of putting it. I don't like putting it that way. But by that, what I mean is that the things that would typically create a conflict if we were in a face-to-face situation, we have to learn not to allow to escalate into a conflict online. And I think this is an individual thing. It's hard to explain that. It's by analogy when Vint Cerf and others were creating the web, creating the internet, the philosophy that they expressed as a guideline for the writing of internet software was be generous in what you accept, be strict in what you send out. And basically what this philosophy was is that you want your internet software to be able to handle all kinds of different input from different systems, in different formats, in different languages, and the rest. You want your internet systems to be as open as possible. And then on the other end, you want your systems to send out information that is as compliant to protocols as possible, so formatted the right way, expressed in the right language, and so on. And this is a mechanism they propose that creates a stable network, that instabilities in the network, you know, errors in coding and that, would be naturally flattened out as the process of communication from entity to entity happened in the network. And my own approach is that the same sort of philosophy has to hold for humans in a human network where people are, I don't want to say more open, more generous, because that's not really what I mean, but people can be in an environment where the information that's being presented to them is of a variety of shapes and forms and flavors, some of which they might currently find offensive, some of which they might currently find foreign in some way. And you just allow that. The information just comes in. And when you react as according to as strict a protocol as possible, as Canadians would say, as politely as possible, in such a way as to, you know, calm any potential conflict-causing source of information. That's simply the way I would approach it. Now, will the internet as a whole approach it that way, I think, is an empirical question. I think that if there was an effort undertaken to foster the sort of virtue I've just outlined, it would make it more likely that the internet could deal with the sort of conflict that is produced by people getting carried away by being anonymous or being a depersonalized entity, if you will. I don't know what else to say on that. Was that helping your or responding in any way adequately to your question?
At least I took at least 2 points of your argument with me.
Okay.
How should we go?
Yeah, Stephen. Thank you very much for your time and your thoughts. I feel a sense of information overload looking around. So, once again, yeah, thank you very much for joining us.
I wanted to cry out. Just one channel.
Absolutely. I would like to hand over to Ulrike for some final words. I don't know exactly.
Yeah.
With regard to recordings and whatever.
Yeah,
organizational
okay.
issues. Stephen, from my side, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.